Well, the date is April 3rd, 2023, 1703 hours. That's interesting. Ward Green here. Today's scripture from Ecclesiastes, or from the writings of the proverb-like parts of the Bible. We have Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 14, which says, I saw all the works that were done under the sun, and look, everything was vanity and a striving after wind. From the 1984 reference version of the New World Translation. Another important scripture which we will mention and to which we will refer today is from, in addition to the book of Genesis, of course, but is from Exodus. Chapter 12, verse 6, with regard to the Passover sacrifice, and it must continue under safeguard by you until the 14th day of this month, that month being Nisan, from Exodus chapter 12, verse 2. What does it say? What does it say in at the end of 11? Okay, it's all right. That's interesting. Right. We know that that was Nisan. I'm just trying to find, well, we know it from later on in the account that it's the month of Nisan. But, because they departed Egypt on the 15th of Nisan. So, we have this information from the Bible also. But, this is the 14th of Nisan when they sacrificed the Passover. It said in verse 6, the whole congregation of the assembly of Israel on the 14th day of that month of Nisan must slaughter it between the two evenings. This is very important. Now, some people render that differently, which I would like to make a mention of also, which in particular I would like to make a mention of with regard to the Septuagint in the Oxford translation, for example. Verse 6, they shall slay it towards evening. They translated between the two evenings as towards evening. A different translation entirely. Now, the reason why between the two evenings is important is because we know when Jesus was sacrificed, he died before evening. So he didn't die between the two evenings. He died prior to the evening. Between the two evenings meant, well, we believe what it means is between, it either means between sunset, oh, that's right, the Sadducees believed one thing about what that meant, and the Pharisees believed something else. But without getting into that, we've discussed that in the articles, and I've talked about that before. Between the two evenings, it either means between sunset and dusk, or it means between the sun first touching the horizon and complete sunset. So it's after the sun touches the horizon is when the first evening occurs. Jesus died before sunset, before any approach of evening, or before the sun first touched the horizon. Ostensibly, he died in the afternoon of the day of, in our chronology, depends which calendar you're using. In the Essene calendar, he died on Nisan 14. In our chronology, on the day of that date in Nisan, in the year 30 CE also. It's in the year, only in the year 30 CE could this have happened. And it's incredibly, because the Essene calendar, they based it on the month of Nisan beginning at the equinox. And we've talked about that in the chapter 12, the Born and Raised article. If you read chapter 12, it talks about that. I know it's a lot of information to digest. But this, because of the Essene's calendar lining up this way in this particular 1 year, 30 CE, only in that year does this work. The Essene Nisan 14 happened 1 day before the Sadducee Nisan 14, and the Sadducee Nisan 14 was the Passover of the Sadducees, but the Pharisees celebrated Passover on the 15th of Nisan because of the way they looked at the sun differently. So it's extremely confusing if we look at all three sects. But when we look at the accounts in the Bible, see between the two evenings. So the only way that Jesus could have died between the two evenings is if he died between the evening of the Essene Passover and the evening of the Sadducee Passover. He did die between the two evenings, you see? So he fulfilled that scripture very, very importantly. See, it's clear that we understand that that's the way prophecy is. It allows fulfillment to come when it otherwise could not have been attainable, but because it's written between the two evenings, and that's the sense, that's the exact literal Hebrew from the original text of the Hebrew text. Because it's written that way, it allows for the fulfillment to be Jesus dying well before evening, but in between the evening of the Essene Passover, which is on the evening of the 12th or 13th, or I suppose you call it, depending on when you, which you call evening. It was at the end, the beginning, I should say, of the 13th in the traditional standard calendar, which we would, it's not the Julian calendar, it's the Jewish calendar. In the traditional Jewish calendar, it was the 13th when Jesus died, but in the Essene calendar, it was the 14th. It was Passover. He died prior to the Passover having been celebrated. So that way they wouldn't have to celebrate it that year. The traditional Jewish adherents, that is the Sadducees and the Pharisees, Jesus died before the Passover of either the Sadducees or the Pharisees, but he died after the Passover of the Essenes in this year. But he died between the two evenings in the sense that he died more in the middle of the day. But it was still between the two evenings because this was a special year. And when we see, there's so much evidence for this. There's a lot of evidence for it. And we've studied it many, many different ways because it's worth studying. On the first day of the unleavened bread, it says in the study Bible in Matthew 26 and 17. How did I get into that Bible? I normally look at the reference Bible, but we can look at the reference Bible. Here it is. On the first day of the unfermented cakes, it's called in the reference Bible. But if we look at the footnote in the reference Bible, it says, on the day before. On the day before the unfermented cakes, it says, you see. But there's no contradiction with any of that because, of course, some people thought, or the Jewish people, some of them regarded the Passover as being a day before the unleavened bread, or it was a celebration. Some of them believed it was to be considered a separate from the festival of unleavened bread, right, which came immediately after that 1 day of the Passover. So it could have been considered as meaning the day of the Passover, but it could also mean the day before the Passover. It has different meanings. If we click on the research guide, the first day of the unfermented cakes there, in the Insight book, it says the first day could be rendered the day before. Concerning the Greek word here translated first, right, the New World Translation says on the day before. Possibly is or, it's or on the day before. This rendering of the Greek word in that way is consistent with the sense and rendering of a similar construction in John, namely, he existed before me. So there's a precedent for that. There's a basis for it. But interesting, if we look at Matthew 26 and 2, he says, you know that 2 days from now the Passover occurs. Isn't that interesting that he says 2 days from now? Whenever that was, we don't know how many days passed after he said this, before he was impaled, but we know that there were 3 days in the year 30 CE in a row of Passovers. The Essene Passover, followed by the Sadducee Passover, followed by the Pharisee Passover. Three in a row. And that's why it's interesting that he says, you know that 2 days from now the Passover occurs. Which Passover is the one to which he's referring is the question. It's very interesting because there are different sects and they celebrate Passover on different days. And the fact that he says 2 days from now makes it possible that he's referring to, well, it sounds like he's the ending, the last part of that verse sounds like he's referring to his own death 2 days from then, because he says he's to be delivered up to be impaled. Right. And then when we go down on the first day of the unfermented cakes, or the day before the unfermented cakes, they asked him, right? Where do you want us to prepare? So how many days pass between the 2 days away and this first day? It doesn't sound like there were too many days that passed when we read the account here. He was at the house of Simon the leper in verse 6. That's the only thing that was said there, apart from the fact the chief priests were gathered together, but that was separate from Jesus. That had nothing to do with the sequence of his events. So then of course there needed to be time, because Judas had to go out to have time, that is, he had to go out to, he had to have time in the sequence to betray Jesus, because otherwise it couldn't have happened, because it said it was after this occurrence here that, but we don't know that this was chronological either. Yeah, it says while he was in Bethany. That's right. It doesn't say when that happened. This could have happened 6 days earlier or some other time when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper. We don't know when that was, but that's when Judas needed, or he could have had time, because there had to be time for Judas to go out and betray Jesus in the account. You know, I mean, there's only one Jesus and there's only one Judas. We don't have to have this same event happening over and over again. It only happened once, but Judas needed to have time to do this. And then the sequence continued on the first day of the unfermented cakes. But the sequence of the first day could have been the day immediately following this statement by Jesus that 2 days from now the Passover occurs. That could have been the day after that statement. So it fits perfectly well with the accounts that there were different days and that Jesus died on the day of the Essene, Nisan 14. Of course, that's very... He had to die on Nisan 14. But the Essene Passover was based on Nisan 14 according to the equinox, which is perhaps the best way of all to consider the month of Nisan, is basing it on the equinox, because originally, of course, everything was meant to be based on the equinox. That's why the calendar had to be adjusted every year according to the equinox. They had to keep doing it, adjusting it. This is a phenomenal thing that proves that Jesus died in the year 30 CE, but more importantly, it resolves a lot of issues with, you know, how can you explain why, you know, the fact that Jesus did away with the Passover when he died, so therefore, how could you prevent other people celebrating the Passover? Well, he'd have to die prior to the actual Passover in order for people to be prevented from celebrating the actual Passover. So it makes perfect, complete sense. It's wonderful. It's exciting. And so it really doesn't matter if we choose to celebrate the Passover as the evening meal the day before the Passover, as Jesus did, or if we celebrate on the day of the Passover, or if we celebrate according to the equinox-based Passover, or whether we celebrate on the 15th of Nisan or the 14th, what difference really does it make, depending on our interpretation of Scripture? What difference would it make? I mean, or Jesus said, keep doing this in remembrance of me, right? That's the main thing. He didn't say when to do it. He just said, do it in remembrance of me. That's the most important thing. So I'm in the study Bible. It's very unusual. Okay, if I change from study Bible to the reference Bible now, that should be a more permanent change, I think. So today's study will be Genesis chapter 34. Is that right? I think it is. That's right. I haven't had time to read it. I just realized. So that'll be interesting. It'll be unprepared reading. But I have read the chapter in the Wild Road article, Little Children, so we're going to read that. If I can find it, I'm clicking on it. There it is. First of all, though, I want to play this song by... What? Oh, I readjusted it and it changed all the paragraphs. It's okay. I'll move it down. Move down to the paragraph. This is 5:9 is the one we're doing. But first, I'd like to play you a song from the 1977 album iRobot, Alan Parsons Project, entitled I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You. That was excellent, wasn't it? So, our article, still, Wild Road, Ahead to History. Today, it's chapter 5, paragraph 9. So, little children, shall we start? Although we ought to be aware of the apparent accuracy of our 2141 BCE date for the start of Assyria, whereby we make Ninus, its first king, to be some name for Gudea and Chedorlaomer, both Abraham's contemporary, with two different names for the same person, as also Naram Sin was his contemporary. He's a different person in his early life. We are hardly fairly more convinced by Jackson's statement that Belus ruled Assyria first and was succeeded by Ninus, according to Africanus, in precisely this identical year, 2141 BCE, according to Africanus. You can find that by looking at the Jackson footnote number 1, and also look in footnote 1 in the paragraph 412. Chapter 4, paragraph 12 above. That footnote 1 in that paragraph 412 refers to the correct page number in the book by Jackson. Striking though the correspondence be, this is that Africanus dated this event of the beginning of the kingdom of Assyria in 2141 BCE. That's the striking correspondence that Africanus gave, the exact date that we found in the genealogy. And that was not by our design. We just discovered this accidentally. Striking though the correspondence be, it's by divine appointment or nothing. There's no randomness in the universe if we believe in Jehovah. It's got to be by Jehovah. Striking though the correspondence be, it adds little, though. It adds little, right? Even though it's this amazing miracle. Because it requires that we also take by Belus that Jackson means the final king to reign in the dynasty of Sargon of Akkad. Who knows? Is it Jackson? Yeah. But by Jackson's statement, Jackson is not the one saying it, but Jackson's quoting other people who are saying that Belus was succeeded by Ninus. So we'd have to take by Belus that he means the final king to reign in the dynasty of Sargon, in the dynasty of Sargon of Akkad, or the dynasty of Akkad, it's called. The dynasty of Sargon of Akkad, the final king, precedes Ninus. In other words, Ninus comes after the dynasty of Akkad, not in the middle. Ninus doesn't come directly after Sargon. Sargon is the first king in the dynasty, and then the last king in the dynasty has a different name from Sargon, and he precedes Ninus. So this Belus who precedes Ninus must be this final king. He can't be Sargon, if we're going to take it literally. An unlikelihood of agreement adds inertia to the date. The fact that we have this incredible correspondence between the date of Africanus, the Christian chronologer, and our own date for the beginning of the kingdom of Assyria. It's unlikely, and so because it's unlikely, it makes it seem like we have something divinely appointed. But the circumstances had already belike convinced us. Had a little burp there. From this arithmetic coincidence, why did the circumstances convince us already? Well, we already came up with the dating. We didn't need that coincidence, but it's just another confirmation. From this arithmetic coincidence and the account given by Jackson and attributed to Abedinus. It's attributed to Abedinus. Perhaps what we said about Belus preceding Ninus is from Abedinus. We may find that that dynasty of Akkad preceded the kingdom of Assyria. There was no other way of knowing it. Nobody in history knows which kingdom preceded which other kingdom. Nobody knows that. We don't know it. unless somebody digs up the ground in such a way that they find layers one on top of the other, and they say this kingdom must have preceded that one, but they wouldn't know if there was a gap of some years in between, would they? I mean, or there's no document that tells us that this kingdom is ruling because we conquered the previous kingdom, and that, you know, they don't give us that information generally. So the confusion about, so we find out from this arithmetic coincidence and the account attributed to Abedinus, because it says Ninus succeeded Belus, right? So therefore we find out that the dynasty of Akkad preceded the kingdom of Assyria, which we would never have known. It's an amazing thing that we found that out. And unless you've studied chronology, you wouldn't know how amazing it is, or it was. It is, in fact, very amazing and very remarkable, very astounding that we actually discovered anything that old, that we could say that one kingdom preceded another. It's very hard. And when you study it, you realize how difficult it is if you're trying to find the truth. The confusion about Ninus being the son of Belus, with son in quotation marks, in several versions, is cleared up by the belief that the king Chedorlaomer was the servant of Amraphel. So that's why he's his son. He's like, son can be figurative, not always the literal son. So Chedorlaomer was the servant of Amraphel, and therefore he was like a son. And for some period, there's also something about Gudea marrying the daughter of some other king or some other... There's something in the account about Gudea. But because the names may not correspond at all with the names that we use, we don't know the person about whom it's saying these things with regard to who the father of this wife of Gudea was. But we're looking for some kind of evidence, right? And any correspondence at all is useful. But Chedorlaomer was the servant of Amraphel for some period, as recounted in the book of Jasher. Right. Chedorlaomer is to us Gudea, and then he turned back and rebelled against Amraphel. Chedorlaomer did. And Chedorlaomer is to us Gudea, the Assyrian Ninus, as Amraphel, also known as Nimrod, is Sharkalishari of Akkad. Or something along those lines, let's say, right? But we don't. The thing is, if we look at different accounts, I was reading one of the papers of Peter Huber the other day, where he was talking about what happened at the time of, at the very end of the dynasty of Akkad, and he had a different way of accounting it, where Sharkalishari was not the very last king, really, of that set of kings who preceded the Assyrian Empire. So it may not have been Sharkalishari, if depending on which, you know, I mean, it's not very important who that was. But should we have any doubt about the date of 2141 BCE as the inception of the Assyrian Empire? Should we have any doubt about that date, 2141? Ctesias had said that it began 1,000 years before the Trojan War, although what date he assigned to that is not clear. And there are the 1903 years of astronomical observations, stated as, perhaps a minimum, preceding Alexander in 331 BCE, their start attributed to the dynasty of Akkad lasting from about 2302 BCE to 2141 BCE. That was the dynasty of Akkad, 2302 to 2141. So they did start in that period, reasonably agreeably stated as being from 2233 BCE, which is 1903 years consecutive. Aren't the numbers beautiful? 2233 BCE for the start of these astronomical records. Such beautiful numbers, so easy to remember. The Assyrian Empire is reported to be 1300 to 1400 years in length, that is. So with its end in 809 in the Blessed Genealogy, or 809 BCE in the Blessed Genealogy, it lasted 1332 years in all. That means 2141 minus 809 is 1332. The difference between the start date and the end date, 21 minus 8 is 13, and 41 minus 9 is 32. So we get 1332. This 1332 is, as computed, is, and look at this, 11 times 11 times 11 plus 1, or 12 times 111. Isn't that something? For these numbers that we get in the genealogy, it's just remarkably memorable and interesting. Okay, so that's it for this Wild Road study for today. I know it was a lot of information, but let's not dwell on it too much. Genesis chapter 34. But, you know, we have to do our... Well, we did the proverb, didn't we? Yeah, we did the Ecclesiastes 1:14. That's right. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob. Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, used to go out to see the daughters of the land. And Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, a chieftain of the land, got to see her, and then took her and lay down with her and violated her. And his soul began clinging to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he fell in love with the young woman and kept speaking persuasively to the young woman. Finally, Shechem said to Hamor, his father, "Get me this young lady as a wife." And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, and his sons happened to be with his herd in the field. And Jacob kept silent until they should come in. Later, Hamor, Shechem's father, went out to Jacob to speak with him, and the sons of Jacob came in from the field as soon as they heard of it, and the men became hurt in their feelings, and they grew very angry because he had committed a disgraceful folly against Israel in lying down with Jacob's daughter, whereas nothing like that ought to be done. And Hamor proceeded to speak with them, saying, "As for Shechem, my son, his soul is attached to your daughter. Give her, please, to him as a wife, and form marriage alliances with us. Your daughters you are to give to us, and our daughters you are to take for yourselves. And with us you may dwell, and the land will become available for you. Dwell and carry on business in it, and get settled in it." Then Shechem said to her father and to her brothers, this is Shechem, the young man, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you will say to me, I shall give it. Raise very high the marriage money and gift imposed upon me, and I stand willing to give according to what you may say to me. Only give me the young woman as a wife." And Jacob's sons began to answer Shechem and Hamor, his father, with deceit, and to speak so because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they went on to say to them, "We cannot possibly do such a thing, to give our sister to a man who has a foreskin, because that is a reproach to us. Only on this condition can we give consent to you, that you become like us, by every male of yours getting circumcised. Then we shall certainly give our daughters to you, and your daughters we shall take for ourselves, and we shall certainly dwell with you and become one people. But if you do not listen to us to get circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go." And their words seemed good in the eyes of Hamor and in the eyes of Shechem, Hamor's son. And the young man did not delay to perform the condition, because he did find delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was the most honorable of the whole house of his father. So Hamor and Shechem, his son, went to the gate of their city and began to speak to the men of their city, saying, "These men are peace-loving toward us. Hence, let them dwell in the land and carry on business in it, as the land is quite wide before them. Their daughters we can take as wives for ourselves, and our daughters we can give to them. Only on this condition will the men give us their consent to dwell with us, so as to become one people, that every male of ours gets circumcised, just the way they are circumcised. Then their possessions and their wealth, and all their livestock, will they not be ours? Only let us give them our consent, that they may dwell with us." Then all those going out by the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to Shechem his son, and all the males got circumcised, all those going out by the gate of his city. However, it came about that on the third day, when they got to be aching, the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, brothers of Dinah, proceeded to take each one his sword and to go unsuspectedly to the city and to kill every male. And Hamor and Shechem his son, they killed with the edge of the sword. Then they took Dinah from Shechem's house and went on out. The other sons of Jacob attacked the fatally wounded men and went plundering the city because they had defiled their sister. Their flocks and their herds and their asses and what was in the city and what was in the field they took, and all their means of maintenance and all their little children and their wives they carried off captive, so that they plundered all that was in the houses. At this Jacob said to Simeon and to Levi, "You have brought ostracism upon me in making me a stench to the inhabitants of the land with the Canaanites and the Perizzites, whereas I am few in number, and they will certainly gather together against me and assault me, and I must be annihilated, I and my house." In turn, they said, "Ought anyone to treat our sister like a prostitute?" And that's the end of Genesis chapter 34. And it was, in fact, if we look back, it was Simeon and Levi who had committed the first act of violence. In verse 25. So that is the story of what happened. Can you imagine all of the house of Hamor and all the men of that city got circumcised? But it was something that Jacob's sons could not live with. And the other sons of Jacob as well followed after Simeon and Levi and acted against the city of Shechem. So it was a very disturbing chapter. We know that the city of Shechem was nearby to where Jacob was living from the previous study yesterday. Jacob came to the city of Shechem. Verse 18 of yesterday's study. So that's today's study, little children. We saw that deceit was used there because it was Jacob's sons who were deceitful there. Right. They convinced Shechem and his father that circumcision would have to be done to all of their people in order for, and that would have been normally true of any of the Israelites. They would all be circumcised. So, and the Israelites, they didn't have the law of Moses yet. They weren't required to marry only among their own people, but they had the custom of marrying only among their own people for good reason. They had good reasons for not marrying the people who lived in the land of Canaan, because they were not worshippers of Jehovah. They didn't have a lot in common with the Jewish worshippers of Jehovah. So it's, I mean, they didn't have the law of Moses yet. So it's a little more nebulous to try to understand what the difference was between the two. But there was clearly a difference because, well, for one thing, we don't see stories of the Jewish sons violating the people of Canaan. We just see the story of Shechem violating the daughter of Leah in this chapter. They didn't have exactly the same training from youth that Abraham's descendants did, that people who worshiped Jehovah had, because of faith in Jehovah, which gave all of Jehovah's people a higher set of morals, a better set of standards, according to which they behaved. Yeah, it's not to say they're not free, right? So I would like to end the study with the saying from the Gospels, and you can fill in the blank. Okay, it's a quiz. It's a question mark. It's an opportunity to fill in the blank. It's a question. The truth shall set you. And then you might say, on your way? No, that's not, it doesn't set you on your way. That's not what it is. The truth will set you firmly? No, it's not that. It's not firmly. No. The truth will set you up? No, it's not up. It's not right. It's not up. Truth will set you down? No, it's not down. Okay, so the truth will set you free. That's right. The truth will set you free. I'm going to risk it and say it's John 8 and 32, just from my memory, but that's my memory of it. But that's right. It's the truth will set you free. It's not something else that Jesus said with regard to that. Okay, so I want to say, my goodness, we have a new member of the family today. Look at this. We have this new member of the family. The logo is upside down. I'm going to take it off. I just got this. I discovered a real gem, a real value, and a beauty of a watch. It is a Japanese watch. One I didn't have, a Japanese automatic watch, which I didn't have. And it's mother of pearl. Mother of pearl dial with the octopus logo. It's got some very nice loom on this, but I don't think I need the loom very much, and I don't think the loom is all that great. I mean, it dies away, you know, at night. You're not going to see in the dark. That's what loom is supposed to give you, the ability to see in the dark. But look, it's got a ceramic bezel. That's very expensive, very long-lasting, scratch-resistant bezel. One-directional bezel. It's got a date. It's got the date, and it's very legible, the date. The only thing I don't like about it is the hands are white. They're gold, surrounded with gold or brass, whatever that color is. Gold, I guess it looks like. But they're white on a white background, but it's mother of pearl. It's mother of pearl. So because it's white on white, it's not the best. That's why I love my Live watch. It's the best watch for legibility that I've ever seen. It's lived. I call that watch Dusty. So I've got Dusty. I have Crow, which is this watch. But you see how this has two white dials on it. So I finally got the third dial. The third white dial to go with the two white dials here, and the, you know, which replaced the 50-year-old watch that I had that had three white dials on it. So two white dials, and there's the third white dial. So finally we have replaced that Waltham 50-year-old chronograph. This is just a normal watch. It's not a chronograph, and it's not a very inexpensive watch, because it has this amazing bezel on it. It's got the mother of pearl dial. It's, you know, it's very beautiful. It's got very high quality loom on it. It doesn't have a see-through back. It's not got that. It's just a normal stainless steel back. It's got the octopus logo on the back too. Right? So it's Phoebos, it's called Phoebos Wavemaster, this particular watch. Automatic Seiko NH35A movement, which is a Japanese automatic movement. So it winds itself also. It's not very lightweight. And look, I put the new strap on it. So this is the brand new strap that I wasn't able to use so far. But because this is not it's not a terribly expensive watch, so I was able to justify using this strap, which is a metallic strap, but it's the new one that I got from Juntan, where you clip it and then you lock it. That's the advantage of that strap. And the pins, the spring bars that came with this watch were good enough quality. It just came with a rubber strap, though, which I don't really want to use. But the other thing about this watch, why it's such a great value, the other thing is that makes it such a great value, that this watch has water resistance up to 300 meters of depth or 1,000 feet of depth. This is, you could actually dive underwater with this watch, do scuba diving. It's that water resistant. I mean, it's not that I would necessarily do that. But this, the value of this watch because of its water resistance. I mean, you would never have to worry about this watch because as long as you've got this, the crown screwed in all the way. It is a screw down. You have to screw it down. But isn't that wonderful? It's just such a wonderful watch. And then snap it shut. And then, I mean, the Seiko movements are well known. The NH35A is the no-name version of the Seiko. The Seiko movement. It's got a different number, but the Seiko movement, which is in this watch, it's made in Hong Kong. It's a Chinese watch with a Japanese movement. So I've got Crow, which is Swiss. I've got Dusty is Swiss, and I've got Phibby. I'm going to call the Amphibia, I guess it's called Vostok Amphibia. I'm calling that watch Phibby, and this watch I'm going to call Moppy because mother of pearl. So Moppy, I've got Phibby, I've got Dusty, and I have Crow. Those are my four watches right now. So these are new watches, and now I don't have to worry too much about keeping time for a little while, I guess. Or I've still got my Casio watch, actually. I haven't given that one a name. I've got two of those, but one of them is the buttons were not working as well on the older one, but they're identical and they both work. But they're just $50 watches. They don't, you know, there's nothing to those. I mean, they're just, you can get a watch for even less money that does probably the same, but they're $50 watches. But I've been considering whether I should buy one of these devices that can detect the beat frequencies. I've downloaded some apps for my phone, for example, and I was able to detect something, but it's not accurate to measure not the beat frequency that I want to measure, really, but how fast or slow they are. But I've been determining how fast or slow. I've been determining that anyway using the standard methods, just timing it according to my, you know, to my laptop online time, the time that's synchronized with atomic time very closely, apparently. So I think right now, I think Moppy is going to be a little fast. 42, 3, 4. Yeah, it's Moppy's two. Moppy is going to be very fast because Moppy's already 2 seconds fast after about 5 hours, I think. 6 hours. Okay, so What's the next? Let's see what we got here. See if we have a song to take us out here. Yeah, this one. This one. The next song. Alan Parsons Project, iRobot 1977. Called Some Other Time. Well, this has been April 3rd, 2023. Thank you for joining me, little children. It's 1758 hours. Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green saying, I love you. Bye for now. Have a wonderful day.